Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of April, and it is actually it's the 6th of April, and it's time for All Things Political, which we always have on Monday at 9 o'clock, and we have a lot of international and national topics to discuss. We'll start probably with North Korea. The rocket that they launched over the weekend may have fallen into the sea. Military experts are saying that it was not really a complete failure because it traveled twice as far as any missile the country has launched. There's yet another huge issue on the table for the President of the United States and for members of the United Nations as well. Joining us this hour is Professor Steve Smith. He is director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University, has worked on Capitol Hill in several capacities, and served as a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also written many books on congressional politics and most recently a book on the formation of the Russian state. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would care to send an email, you can, and that address is talk@wpr.org. Obviously, all things political means all kinds of conversations are up for discussion this hour, so call with what you will. Professor Steve Smith, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. Good to be with you.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Well, let's start with North Korea's rocket. Why in the world would they send it off now, and how does the world respond to this one?
Well, I don't know that anyone's particularly expert on what motivates the North Korean
right.
government. You know, my guess is that they would like to have a technology that would give them some bargaining leverage. You know, they might face some UN sanctions, the details of which are still being pounded out in New York. But I think in the long run, they expect they learn from the past. They gain some support from the West promising to shut down their nuclear program, and maybe they want to buy some additional outside support by promising not to fire another missile. But they have to demonstrate the technology before they get that leverage. The other thing we fear, of course, is that, as in so many other areas, the North Koreans will sell the technology to others in the Third World.
Mm-hmm.
And while not too many other countries may be interested in the long-range rocketry, even have greater short-range capability would be a serious problem in several regions.
The president remarked in Prague, "It's a strange turn of history. The threat of global nuclear war has gone down, but the risk of a nuclear attack has gone up."
Yeah, I do think that it's a challenge to the new administration. It's hard to tell whether the North Koreans have timed this in order to test the new American administration, but because their technological development probably has a schedule of its own. But it does pose a leadership issue for Obama at just the time when he's trying to get the world to coalesce on other issues, Afghanistan and Pakistan, on the economic front and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. What does it do for his plan that he was talking about while in Europe to reduce the stockpiles of nuclear weapons both in the United States and in Russia?
Well, I think that's going to sound very good to the Russians. And, he wants to get our relations with the Russians off on a stronger foundation than we've had in the past. And, of course, in Europe, the chest beating that we saw out of the Bush administration, at least as seen by the Europeans, created serious public opinion problems for us. And Obama would like to strengthen America's image in Europe. Now, it's oftentimes said, "Well, who cares?" The public's attitude in Europe conditions their government's willingness to cooperate with the United States, just in a very general way. So we would prefer to have Europeans think highly of us than to think poorly of us. And I'm sure that Obama thinks that his hope for a more multilateral foreign policy depends on more support from the average European.
Right. Well, you just send Michelle Obama there then as often as possible, right?
That helps. That helps.
Right.
But there's no substitute for some real policy changes, at least as seen by the Europeans.
Mm-hmm. He did, in terms of presenting a different American image, really do something different this go-around, didn't he? I mean, the crowds that sure. met him, the press coverage that was received in Europe was quite something.
Well, it is. And, you know, he is extremely closely followed over there. We knew that his family was receiving lots of media attention. But, you know, many Americans don't appreciate how closely major developments in American politics are covered by news outlets in Europe and around the world. The presidential election was a dominant story in almost everywhere else in the world. So people know and have seen Barack Obama, and he's about a bit of a pop star in most places throughout the world. To have him there, of course, then creates a bit of a sensation. Mm-hmm. And the real question is how the administration, how the State Department uses that to the advantage of the United States. This is a quite remarkable visit, very extensive and fairly long. In Turkey today, giving a talk to the parliament of one of the largest Muslim countries in the world. So this really is a major move on the part of the president.
Mm-hmm. And those little things, I love, you probably saw the article in the New York Times yesterday from A.A. Gill for the Sunday Times of London, talking about just the little things that they did, shaking the hand of the Bobby at 10 Downing Street, which had never
right.
been done before, you know, and how it lightened that person. And then the press made much of that and going way out of their way to personally thank all of the servants for looking after them. Just this kind of graciousness and classlessness, too.
Well, that's right. That's right. And it symbolizes who in the United States Obama represents in the eyes of many Europeans. Just who is he representing? Most Europeans realize that the United States is a large, complex society, and they got a sense that George Bush was not representing many of the people with whom they would most closely sympathize, and Obama does. So little symbolic gestures like that make a world of difference.
Do you he didn't fare very well when it came to asking the people for help, the European countries, to help fighting what's going on in Afghanistan. Why did he fall short there, do you think?
Well, sending troops abroad is no more popular in Europe than it is in the United States. And there's a feeling in many places in Europe that while these troops would be under their own commanders, the fact is it's basically a U.S. operation. They really don't like that very much. They don't like sending troops into an area where the policy is really not being determined by their own governments. We wouldn't like that much either. So that's part of the problem. Part of it is basically the free rider problem. Why should they when they think the United States will do it anyway? Why put their boys at risk when they don't have to? And so it becomes a very difficult sell for the governments of Europe, at least over the long run. Of course, they were very involved from the start, but maintaining this commitment and expanding it is difficult for governments to justify there.
What about the G20 summit? Did you see anything of substance come from that?
Well, it's a little too hard to tell. Most of the substance is in the form of promises, and no one should have expected otherwise. We did not expect whole new international institutions to be created that could impose the will of the international community on domestic economies. That was never in the cards. But there were some relatively important developments there. The creation of what's called the Financial Stability Board out of what used to be or has been called the Financial Stability Forum to give it more teeth, to give it more oversight, and to explicitly authorize it to collaborate with the IMF to give advance warning of the kinds of economic troubles we've had here in the last year, I think is pretty important. The commitment to more than $1 trillion of new money for IMF and IMF-related programs is real. That's really quite substantial. And the agreement in principle to impose new regulations on a variety of things, financial institutions, new financial instruments, even executive compensation schemes. All the participants agreed to those general principles. Now, they have to do it individually, but these were really pretty substantial commitments.
Let's look at some news that wasn't very happy that came last week, and again, it's the release of unemployment numbers. Unemployment numbers, I was checking to see exactly what they were, went up. On Friday, there was news the rate was up to 8.5%, a 25-year high. When he gets home, there's a lot to deal with on this front, isn't there? What are we going to do, and why isn't the stimulus package changing those numbers?
Well, no one expected the stimulus package to have an instant effect. I think that the administration has been making some moves, especially in the banking sector, that have improved things on Wall Street over the last few weeks. But the core economy, manufacturing and other parts of the economy, are not going to improve for some time, even under the rosiest scenario, under the stimulus package, or really under any stimulus package. I think we all understand that the transportation projects, roads projects, building new bridges, improving infrastructure takes time. That doesn't happen instantly. Those jobs aren't created instantly. And other parts of the stimulus package don't really kick in for many months. So I think this is a case where even under the stimulus package, they expected unemployment to continue to rise through most of the rest of this calendar year, and that the best they could do is slow the increase and then hope that by the fourth quarter of 2009, it slowed to about no more increase and maybe even turn around in the first quarter of 2010. That's the best anyone was projecting. We become impatient. We forget that maybe even just 6 weeks ago, hardly any American thought that this problem would be solved inside the year. So I think we become a little impatient. The real problem, I think, for the administration is to persuade the American people and Congress that some deficit spending is essential to making the stimulus work. After all, you want to prime the pump. You want to put more cash out in the economy than you're taking out. That necessarily means a deficit. But yet our underlying core values make us nervous about large deficits and putting that debt onto our children. So this is a difficult balancing act the administration is playing, and it's not real clear yet that they can keep this up.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think when you talked about the possibility of things being turned around by 2010, early in 2010?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have faith that it will?
Well, you know, this is where I'm a political scientist, not an economist, so I'll start begging off a clear answer. My misfortune is that I talk to economists every day, and I think most of them are pretty certain that the first quarter in 2010 will be a quarter in which unemployment has stopped rising, that more of the economic indicators, manufacturing sector, new orders, other things will begin to improve. Most of them are reasonably confident now that falling interest rates, the new practices at Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the injection of some capital into the housing markets will help clear the markets. That'll take probably more than a year. So people are hoping to see an improvement in their housing prices, probably have to be more patient than that. But on the employment side, things should be much better by January.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take that in a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday. Professor Steve Smith is our guest, director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. How do you think the president's European trip has been going, his various stops, a lot of substance to this long week for the president and for his wife, Michelle, and now they'll come home and get a puppy, right? So that will dominate the news for a couple days. You know it will. People are interested in that. Do you think substantial events have happened as a result of the meeting. What do you think about North Korea launching a long-range missile? How does the world community deal with that issue? We want to talk a little bit more about the president's comments on test ban treaty, really lessening the number of nuclear weapons that both this country and Russia has, and how that would be accomplished. And we'll talk about employment news more and the budget, etc. Our lines are open for you. 800-486-8655 is the number. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now. 800-486-8655 is the number. And John from Onalaska is our first caller. Hi, John.
Hello, thank you. I would like our guest, if you would please, to comment on two things. Number one is I keep getting the feeling that, you know, Europe really isn't doing their share in helping to control some of these world problems. I believe you probably, being an economist, you know, I think the economic...
He's a political scientist.
The EU is the largest economic, powerhouse in the world. And I just don't, it's larger than the U.S., and they should be doing more. That's not comment number one, and we should comment on that. Number two, North Korea. I mean, the key to North Korea, it seems to me, is China. And, China really supports North Korea. And I don't know what is to their advantage to have North Korea, you know, sort of a thorn in the world side, but there seems to be something, some advantage to them to have this Korea exist. It seems to me that if we would offer Russia, say, well, if we didn't have to worry about this North Korean missile, we would perhaps be able to back off on our missile shield in Europe. And Russia perhaps has a better power with China than we do. What do you think about those things?
Let's start with the EU. Many central banks and governments in the EU states have stepped up and responded strongly to meet the economic crisis. Many of them do this far more automatically than we do because their social welfare states are far more extensive than ours. So they end up, as unemployment increases and other social problems arise due to the economic situation, their spending goes up automatically and at a faster rate than ours does. In addition to that, many of their systems have supported the banks. Case could be made that we wouldn't have taken quite the steps we did as soon as we did if the British had not shown the way. So I think it's a hard case to make that the Europeans have not done their part. Of course, many of the problems in the general economy, the recession, they share, and they're eager to address those, just as eager as we are, and many of them with governments that are more to the left than ours have been doing even more than we have. On the North Korea situation in China, I'm not really an expert on it, but here's what I know, and that is that the relationship between North Korea and China is a complicated one. There's a great deal of labor from North Korea that spills over into China. China, actually, I think, in spite of its large population, likes to have a lot of that cheap labor from North Korea. They have fairly serious border issues with North Korea. They're not real happy to have an unstable situation there. I think China would like to see that situation repaired. Now, whether they'd like to see a strong capitalistic democracy in North Korea is, I think, another matter. But they're not real happy with the situation in North Korea right now. I think the Chinese have been critical in the past to negotiating with the North Koreans on their nuclear weapons program and on other issues. So I think it may be a little unfair to imply that they've been more of a problem than a help with respect to North Korea.
And what is happening with this missile shield program?
Well,
The administration has indicated a willingness to talk with the Russians about how that shield might be part of a larger discussion involving nuclear disarmament, a change in policy on the part of the Russians toward Iran, especially. And so, right now, it's I think it's fair to say that it's more up for grabs. That it's not as likely as it was under President Bush that we'll go forward with the full shield, and it could very well be that it'll be a part of a larger. It already is a part of a larger set of issues under discussion with the Russians.
Are we spending a lot of money on it right now, or are we working on it?
I don't think money is the issue here at all. It does cost something, but for the most part, this is technology we already have and equipment we already own. So it's really a question of deployment.
Thanks, John, very much for your call. 800-486-8655 is our number for all things political. Barry from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Barry.
I'm aware of a procedure called a reconciliation available to the Senate to avoid filibuster, avoid the 60-vote requirement, replace it with a straight majority vote. The Republicans used it to get the Bush tax cuts for millionaires passed in the previous administration. My question for your guest is, how do you invoke, what's the process for invoking reconciliation?
Yeah. A little background is required. In the Senate, a minority of senators, if they're a large minority, can prevent a vote on a matter. They do that by filibustering. To overcome their filibuster, you need to get 60 votes in support of a cloture motion. If the cloture motion is adopted by three-fifths of the Senate, then the debate continues, and eventually there's a vote on the bill. And the vote on the bill itself always takes place on the basis of a simple majority. So the 60-vote requirement is simply to get that final vote, but the final vote under the Senate's rules is always a simple majority. So the real question is whether or not the health care bill that the administration will support and that will be developed by congressional Democrats will be subject to a filibuster, and whether, therefore, you have to get 60 votes to overcome the filibuster in order to get eventually to a vote that would always be by a simple majority.
Right.
Now, in 1974, Congress decided, and the Senate agreed, that there are some matters, major budget bills, that are so important that they should not be subject to a filibuster, and that there should be a time limit imposed. So last week, the Senate and the House passed the budget resolutions under a 50-hour debate limit, which is basically three long days and maybe more of debate. And but the act guarantees that there be finally a vote. Well, that budget act provided for a special kind of legislation called reconciliation legislation that would be subject to that kind of a debate limit, and therefore not be subject to a filibuster. And as you say, the Republicans in 2001 and again in 2003 imposed called their tax cut bills, reconciliation bills, because conveniently those tax cut bills then would not be subject to a filibuster and they could be adopted on final passage without the cloture motion. The Democrats now want the same for potentially for health care legislation or energy legislation, and cite the precedent that the Republicans set in 2001, 2003 for tax bills. And so your question was, how do they do this? Well, reconciliation bills are ordered by the budget resolution, and the House and the Senate passed their versions of the budget resolutions last week. The Senate bill included no reconciliation language, and the House bill did. And so now those two bills are going to conference committee that sometime over the next few weeks will be negotiated. The outcome is indeterminate yet. We don't know whether the Senate Democrats will accept reconciliation as
proposed in the House bill, or whether the House will back down and say, okay, we'll go without reconciliation for health care. But if they do, that conference report would be approved by the House and the Senate, and that would put in place a mechanism for considering health care with no filibuster.
So all they have to do is order it
by the budget resolution.
Both House and Senate agree and then pass the resolutions with a simple majority,
right,
then it's in effect.
Right.
Oh, okay, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And that's how the Republicans did it in 2001. The Democrats raised a stink about it. They said, you're going to regret this precedent.
Yeah, I know.
And on most things procedural, eventually you do regret the precedent that you set.
Thank you.
Thank you,
sure.
Barry.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Chris next from Glendale. Hi, Chris.
Could the guest please define organic conservatism? And it's my recollection that this assumption is that there are phenomena not embodied in any particular citizen. Do you know much about this?
I know nothing about that. That's an interesting concept. I'll write it down and check it out sometime. But
where does it come? What are the origins of it, Chris?
Well, about 20 years ago, I recall reading this in a book on political science. And what I'm about to say, I have no opinion on this. I just wanted to add that this is the idea that among conservatives that there are certain attitudes, beliefs, behaviors, maybe messages, that really do not reside in any one person, but in the aggregate, they exist, and they've got to be preserved. One would be, don't eat too many candy bars at work. Another one would be, don't have sex four times a day with three different people. Another would be, when you see a flag, you should respect it. Another would be, don't live beyond your means. And lately, over in the hard sciences, there's this emergence of something called chaos theory and complexity and something called emergent phenomena. This seems to be similar to this idea from political science. What I was going to ask is there such a thing on the political left? Is there organic liberalism? And maybe the answer is no. Maybe a standard pure liberal would be mindful of individual rights and less concerned about preserving some vague notion about the church or God or conservative purist Puritan dictates.
Well, I think I get the general direction, but that I haven't associated it with that particular term. At least not major groups or do not seem to be using that term. But surely people on both the right and the left believe that society is more than the sum of its parts, that the values that we should hold high have to do with more than merely self-interest, that there are collective interests that emerge from our lives as social beings, as part of larger societies, and that these are important values, and that a role of government is to look out for those values. So surely on the left, environmental values, social welfare values would be in that general category. One of the things that changes our politics from time to time is in the kind of emphasis or salience that we associate with values in that set on one side or the other.
And thank you very much for the call. Some lines are open. If you'd like to join All Things Political, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We had some horrendous shootings over the past couple days, that haunting shooting in Binghamton, New York, and then in Pittsburgh, the police officer shot, and I'm wondering about your thoughts on this. And there have been some questions about whether or not deep recession can result in this kind of violence. I wonder if there will be more calls for gun control in this country. What do you make of those? That the one in Binghamton is particularly awful. Not that all deaths aren't awful in this regard, but just the image of these people from all over the world studying to be citizens, and oh, it just got to you, didn't it?
Oh well, these are tragedies that are so so shocking that that it's hard to it's just hard to manage them emotionally. There are always calls for action on gun control when that happens. That doesn't seem to be in the cards. This is an administration that I think is trying to avoid picking a fight on gun control. In a president who's taken a for a Democrat anyway, a very moderate position on gun control. So I think clearly this administration doesn't want that issue to get in the way of the other things that it's giving priority, healthcare reform and energy and environment and so on. So as awful as it is, and we always see a flurry of bills introduced in state legislatures and in Congress when tragedies like this occur, but I think this is actually a time when, even with a Democratic president, we're not going to see any significant action on the part of Washington.
And what about the link between a deep recession and violence?
Well, I think that that's always a worry. We do know that family violence goes up, that it's in economic hard times. It's a real challenge to the sense of self-worth that many people have when they lose a job, are unable to care for their family properly. So it's a serious worry, and it's one reason why I think we really should be concerned about where this economy is going. And for my own money, be fairly tolerant of an administration that's willing to take some risks in order to turn around quickly rather than slowly.
We go to Michael from Milwaukee next. Hi, Michael.
Hello, how you guys doing today? And I just had a quick question. With all the talk of a global economy, I was just wondering, from a political standpoint, is the talk of global currency going to follow? And how receptive would the world be to a type of global currency?
Well, if we have a global currency, it's the dollar, and that's not going to change. There was some scare talk over the last couple of weeks in the lead-up to the G20 meetings about the G20 doing something on a global currency. It was nothing but I can't even characterize how ludicrous this is. So it's not in the cards. This is not an administration that's in the least interested in that. I think they are interested in preserving the role of the dollar in the world economy, and I think most people around the world are interested in that, too.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Scott is next from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm an emergency room physician, and I wonder, in my daily practice, I see just a monumental amount of waste that's actually imposed by the federal government. In the emergency room, we have to see every comer. We have to provide full services, no matter what their medical needs are. And, you know, we see huge numbers of people who are repetitively, ongoingly non-compliant with recommendations. We see people who continue to abuse themselves and then want to be fixed at enormous expense. We see, I could go on for days about this kind of topic, but it is an you know, futile, expensive efforts for people who are, frankly, at the end of their lives and their families simply can't accept it. And we invest huge amounts of wasted money on this sort of endeavor. And I'm wondering if you are familiar enough with the team and the process that the Obama administration has put together to kind of outline how they're going about it. And do you have an opinion about whether those kind of nitty-gritty day-to-day details that every physician in the country faces will, and every patient, I mean, one way or another, will be, well, whether those will be attended to or whether this is going to be watered down to the point where it's kind of pointless. And I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, I think that the Obama administration is worried about, I think it's fair to say, two things primarily. One of which is surely strongly related to what the doctor just related to us, and that is the cost of the healthcare system. Cost containment is essential, I think they believe, to the success of any plan. To keep the costs under some control, more control than they are currently, is certainly seen as essential the long-term success of covering everyone with some form of health insurance, which is their second primary goal. In fact, it's probably the primary goal of getting everyone covered. It would be, I think, cost-effective, the administration surely would argue, that many of those people that the doctor sees in an emergency room context have health insurance so that they're not in the emergency room, so that they're seen in clinics or other appropriate locations. So I think the administration believes that these parts of the healthcare challenge are so closely connected to each other that we can no longer do it in a piecemeal fashion. And so they've clearly given it healthcare reform their highest priority, right behind the economy. And I see that the congressional committees, especially the House Ways and Means and the Senate Finance Committees, which have huge jurisdictions over Social Security and Medicare and of course, tax legislation, are giving health care their top priority. So we're going to see bills coming to the floor in the summer, and the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Max Baucus, just said, I think it was just yesterday, that he intends to get a bill to the president's desk by August. That may be overly optimistic, but it reflects, I think, the high priority they have. And so, you know, I think the real answer for the doctor from the administration's point of view is that we have to have a comprehensive plan so everyone's covered, and we do not see the same kind of waste in emergency rooms that we've been seeing now for years.
And how closely tied is this issue to the economic downturn? How vital is it to fix health care in order to fix the economy?
Well, it is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, we have a long-term problem of adjusting ourselves to the modern economy. And the modern economy is one in which people will be changing jobs many times during their lives. They'll probably have to go back and get reeducated two or three times during their lives. That kind of retraining puts their health care coverage in jeopardy. So getting in place a new framework for health care is essential to the future of the economy. That's what the president says, and I think that's how they plan to design their plan. On the other hand, in the short run, a transition to a new framework for health care is very expensive. And at a time when dollars are in short supply, federal revenues are short because the economy is not performing well, and you need those dollars for short-term investment, stimulus package, and other purposes, it ends up being difficult to find that money. Thus, the congressional Democratic budget resolutions were written by Democrats who are in support of substantial health care reform do not include a space for health care. That's not to say that they oppose it now. It's just that they say that health care plan, when it comes forward, will have to pay for itself. That's not going to be coming out of other funding. So the real challenge for the Democrats is to find a funding mechanism. And right now we're worrying about the nature of the health care plan, but believe me, by the time this is over, much of the fight will be over how it's funded.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Here's the number for you to join our All Things Political conversation for this Monday. Our guest is Professor of Social Sciences, Director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy, a Professor of Political Science at Washington University. Steve Smith is with us. He's worked on Capitol Hill. He has served as a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and has written many books on congressional politics and recently a book on the formation of the Russian state. 800-486-8655 if you want to comment on the president's trip to Europe and his many meetings with NATO and G20 and with Turkey today, and his comments on North Korea, on the world economy, et cetera. Feel free to do that, or all the domestic issues that there's a lot going on, isn't there? All the domestic issues that we're dealing with as well. Feel free to join us. We also have an email address in case you can't get through on the phone today. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, it's our open line for March and April. We forgot to do one last month. I'm sorry. So it's March and April. I'm sure that you have a lot of ideas that you've been waiting to get on the air to explain what they are. So that's coming up after the news. Our number now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest is Professor Steve Smith. We're talking all things political, and there is much to be discussing. We'll get to the auto companies in the United States in just a moment, and looking at this very, very extensive trip that the President of the United States has been on. And we're talking about health care and the budget and just issue after issue. Let's go next to Bill from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill. Hello. You're on the air. Bill? Hello, Bill.
I think you're used to be over there.
Bill, are you there?
You know, I don't want to head in the wrong direction.
All right. Bill is not there yet. Let's figure out. We'll take more phone calls in a moment as they're coming in. Let's talk about GM for just a moment before we go back to phone calls, Professor Smith.
Sure.
They have less than 60 days now. Any indications that that company, that's a really major event in this country, isn't it?
No, it is.
Yeah.
Needless to say, this was a company that once had over half the auto market, now is struggling to maintain anything close to 20%. And a number of small businesses around the country, there's an auto dealership, a GM auto dealership of one kind or another in virtually any town of more than a few thousand across the country. So there's it's a massive issue. There's been a great deal of focus on the need for the company to deal with the union, with its union costs, and I think that is a real challenge. But an awful large part of the challenge is to do something about the dealership networks. And these are small business people with a lot of influence in their communities. They have state laws protecting their franchises. And so the problem here is massive. And I think that the administration is, well, I think they're deadly serious about the possibility of pushing the company through bankruptcy if they can't come up with a restructuring plan that probably will cut the company down to 50 or 60% of what it is even now.
Yes. Let's go to Jeremiah from Appleton. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hello. One thing that I haven't heard discussed a lot and is really interesting to me is Russia's supply of oil is supposedly incredibly vast, and I wonder why we haven't done more to develop there. It would certainly help their economy. It would certainly help our relations with them. It would certainly stabilize the region a lot more. It would help us disarm and recover a lot of the nuclear waste that was there, and it would help with the oil supply.
Well, the United States is, and American oil companies have been very involved in Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union. They moved in very, very quickly. Some of them found that their investments went to waste because of the rather weak political and legal system of Russia, where they found that contracts weren't honored, investments were basically stolen, and so there's some reticence about doing a lot there. But keep in mind that the Russian oil companies themselves are filled with talented individuals. They have a lot of capital. They can buy the technology and talent that they need to exploit their resources, and they've been doing it on a massive scale. So Russian oil is becoming and has been a very, very important part of the world's oil market, and the Russian economy itself has done
extremely well when the price of oil is up and suffers a lot when it's down. So I honestly do not think that a lot more U.S. Help is really needed now to help the Russians on that score.
Bill from Oshkosh. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead, Bill.
Thank you. Interesting discussion. Very wise professor, I think, on both sides of the issues nicely. The question is, Mrs. Obama seemed to outshine in the picture I saw Mrs. Sarkozy in the Obama's trip to Europe. And I was wondering if the symbolic effect of the young Obama couple, their glamour, their intelligence, you know, their training, and how that impacted Europe, but also perhaps much more importantly is how their kind of symbolic appearance and, I guess you'd say, intellectual content, how will it marry with American policy or his projected policies in a practical sense to build alliances with Europe or to shape further joint multilateral policies?
Well, you've touched on, there are several dimensions here. I'm not sure we have time to get into all of them, but certainly style is a big part of it. The fact that Obama is so articulate, is able to communicate so well, is important in Europe as it is in the United States. Much of appeal to Americans stems from that, from the fact that he represents change. The fact that he's the first American black president matters a lot in Europe, as it does here. So the fact that he kind of embodies a new generation, a new outlook, is important there and makes it much easier for European leaders to break themselves of their old habits in dealing with the U.S. government and be open to new gestures. The French situation, of course, is important in Europe. France has always set itself apart with respect to especially military affairs, and the fact that the French are moving in the direction of full membership in NATO, I think, is important, not only militarily, but I think in other ways, too. The French have always played hard to get in world affairs. They are a reluctant ally on many things, and I think the new French government, combined with the new American government, creates new possibilities that are really, so far, working in the U.S. interest, and I think could be very important to Europe.
Interesting question. Thanks, Bill. Emil from Baskerville. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
I just think that the national health care issue needs to be addressed state-by-state level. I think it's when I first came back to Wisconsin in, I think it was 2002, I remember Doyle signing a multi-billion dollar deal for this state health insurance. And it seems to me that I know people who've had to have Badger Care, and it's very inadequate in its actual coverage. It seems that if they wrapped up all the state employees into the Badger Care, the pool would be better, and the payouts could be controlled properly. The persons at the bottom would be able to get the dental health care and the eye care that the state employees enjoy. And then you would have a competitive alternative from the state as a single payer to against other corporations. I don't know, an example would be Harley-Davidson or somebody in Milwaukee or whatever, to buy into this system. Therefore, the private healthcare system would probably not be able to compete, and in the American way would therefore become extinct. I think that this has never been mentioned or addressed. There's too much political money. I can't imagine what the guy who made the deal with Doyle and his administration is probably down in Tahiti enjoying a golf game on the residual payments. And I just would like to see some of this done in a national level, state by state.
Well, I think he seems to be making two points. One is to let the states go about their business, and the other is essentially a case for single payer. The administration is committed to a national system. Just how much freedom states might have to trump the national system by offering more generous benefits or stiffer requirements to maybe expand coverage beyond what the federal government demands isn't clear yet. I think that'll be a bit of an issue because we do have states like Massachusetts that have had now statewide universal coverage plans in place for a while, and they probably do not want the federal policy to hamper that. The administration has made it pretty clear that they're not in the game of establishing a single-payer system. I think there may be members of the central administration healthcare team that might like to see that, but it's been ruled out, I think, for political reasons, if nothing more. Exactly what form the healthcare reform will end up taking really isn't clear.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye because we're out of time. Professor
sure.
Smith, thank you so much for being with us. It was
my
a great
pleasure.
Hour. Thank you. We'll call again. Professor Stephen Smith, director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University. We thank him for being with us for all things political this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing here on the air. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll return with another hour right after the news on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.